Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Yes. I don't want to disappoint you, but this is not a particularly radical idea. North Dakota has had it for the last, the 1920s. I mean, and the goal here is, what we want to do is try to get that money, recycle that money back into the community, into the decent jobs, protecting agriculture, protecting our environment. So rather than giving the money to Wall Street to do whatever they will do with it, which will in almost every instance be a negative, I do believe that we should use that money to improve life here in the state of Vermont.
And with that brief exchange, the public banking movement in America took a giant step forward in the process of increasing its visibility and popular support. Hello. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, here with another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. And in case you didn't recognize that Brooklyn accent, it was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders issuing one of the more desired acknowledgments that some public banking supporters have hoped to hear, the word yes. Clear-throated support for a public bank in the state of Vermont, and by implication, the rest of America too. Bernie Sanders' support for creating a state-owned bank there, and his rationale, will move the needle nationally as folks around the country work together to try to find new ways out of a financial system that has entrapped them in a downward spiral of more debt and reduction of financial prospects. As we'll hear later in the show, the citizens' battle for a state bank in Vermont has been through a lot of political subterfuge and struggle, with broad popular support undermined by a handful of public officials who have blocked progress for years. We'll talk to one of public banking's most active protagonists, Gwendolyn Hallsmith, about what Bernie Sanders' endorsement means for their efforts. And there was another high-visibility endorsement of public banking recently from the iconic anti-corporatist crusader Ralph Nader, who had Ellen on his radio show for an exchange of ideas. We'll get to that later as well. But now, let's connect with Ellen, who's just returned to the U.S. after a number of speaking engagements, the most recent of which took a dive into the deep state and how the captains of the financial world occupy a realm of control far beyond the constraints and perceptions of national politics. When we talk about our money, it's necessary to divest ourselves of the prevailing myths about what money is, who issues it, and who really controls it. In fact, as economist Michael Hudson says, even the academic canon of economics is filled with deceptions that are imposed by some of these deeper powers of influence, and that most of what we consider to be precepts of economic truths would make it really impossible for societies to exist for long, because they perpetuate systems of favoritism that would undermine sustainable societies through the shifting of privilege and the institutionalization of poverty and deprivation. But that's a discussion for another day. Today, Ellen reflects a bit on how the new Trump administration is shaking up some established notions about financial policy and objectives, and even taking a shot at restoring a version of FDR's Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banks from depository banks, which kept financial corporations from commingling depositor dollars, that's our money, and city and state money, from the roulette wheel of global finance. I ask Ellen about her observations of Trump's financial direction so far.
Well, I've heard several people reviewing his 100 days and what the record's been so far. So he's succeeded in doing some of his campaign promises. He's totally failed on some others or gone back on them or reversed them, whatever, which has a lot of people upset. But the ones that particularly interest me, of course, are on banking. And so he and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn said that they're considering a 21st century version of the Glass-Steagall Act. So they'd be separating investment banking from commercial banking as it was in the 1930s, as the Roosevelt bill that got mostly repealed in 1999. So that's very interesting. A lot of people have been pushing for that, a big banking reform. So that would break up the big banks. Mnuchin and Cohen are both Goldman Sachs people, so I guess they don't really care too much. I mean, Goldman Sachs wouldn't be all that affected because they were an investment bank to start with. They've gotten a little bit into commercial banking, but largely I think so they can take advantage of the FDIC and, the perks that a depository bank gets. But the banks that would be particularly alarmed by that would be J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and the big banks that have really merged their investment banking and their commercial banking. So that's one thing.
Is it even possible, is it realistic to think about being able to break apart the scale of the unification between investment and depository banks? It's enormous, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. How could that even be done?
Well, for example, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch and Bank of America are linked. So that means that Merrill Lynch is gambling with our deposits at Bank of America, which is very risky for the deposits. But on the other hand, if the big investment banks are not using the deposits, then they're actually more risky and more likely to go down than if they are linked to a depository bank, as was seen when Lehman Brothers went down. They were just an investment bank, so they didn't have a depository bank base to draw from, and the problem was liquidity. They couldn't get the short-term loans that they needed to float all their investments. So on the one hand, it is said that it's actually safer, in a way, to have commercial banking and investment banking linked because it gives them a pool to draw from. But on the other hand, it's obviously risky for our deposit that they could disappear, and the FDIC is not going to have the money to cover, if it's a big derivatives bust that everybody worries about, the $250 trillion in derivatives that U.S. banks are holding.
So if they actually were able to pull that off, does that mean that depository banks might then be forced to go back into making loans to to people as opposed to buying paper?
Well, that's a good point. Yes, it does seem that way, doesn't it?
Well, I don't even know if they'd know how to do that anymore.
So that's all interesting to watch. And then Patrick McHenry, who is the vice chairman of the House Committee on Financial Services, just wrote a letter to, this is January 31st, but he did write a letter to Fed Chairman Janet Yellen saying, and I quote, "Despite the clear message delivered by President Donald Trump in prioritizing America's interest in international negotiations, it appears that the Federal Reserve continues negotiating international regulatory standards for financial institutions among global bureaucrats in foreign lands without transparency, accountability, or the authority to do so. This is unacceptable." So what he's saying basically is that we're allowing the Bank for International Settlements and the Financial Stability Board to set our rules, and that this is unacceptable. So on the one hand, this is alarming European banks, European regulators, because if we don't comply with the Financial Stability Board regulations, then they won't work. I mean, they have to pretty much cover everybody. That's why they're trying to drag everybody into the BIS net. But we've never trusted the BIS. It was in 1944, I think Keynes called for the breakup of the BIS.
Well, let me just interrupt by saying the BIS is the Bank of International Settlements, Central Bank of Central Bank.
Right. And the Financial Stability Board, the G20 all voted to comply with the Financial Stability Board regulations in the spring of 2009 when they all got together in London. So it has the effect of law, although they're not mandatory, but everybody's supposed to comply with them, so in that sense, they are mandatory. So we're marching to the drummer of people in Europe pulling the strings of our banks, and so that's what the objection is. And I would agree that that is not a good thing. The Basel I regulations were what bankrupted the Japanese banks, basically, in the late 1980s when the capital requirement was raised from 6% to 8%, they were then the biggest creditors in the world, and that's what brought down the Japanese economy. Basel II was the mark-to-market rule, which required banks to refigure their capital so that instead of marking their capital as valued at what it might fetch in a good market, like your mortgage-backed securities, you would wait to sell them until there was a good market for them. They were supposed to mark as what they would sell for today, which meant at that time that was when the housing market was collapsing. So there was no real market for the mortgage-backed securities. So that totally froze credit in U.S. banks, and that's what triggered the 2008 collapse. And Basel III is, which is, you know, the third set of regulations coming out of the Financial Stability Board from Basel, is killing the small banks because these regulations are so difficult to comply with that the small banks are having to sell out to the big banks. And they're also killing the Sparkasse banks in Germany, for example, which are complaining that they already have their own set of regulations and their own protections, their own insurance among themselves, and now they're having to comply with these other rules as well, which is also crippling them. So it's not necessarily a good thing to have to comply to regulations imposed by Europe or by a European.
Yeah. The Basel III, is that about changing the capital base for the banks to raising the amount of capital that's required?
Yeah, that's one of the requirements, raising the capital requirement. But there are all these regulations that require a lot of reporting. Apparently, it's just very expensive to try to comply with those regulations. The little banks just can't do it, so they wind up selling out to the big banks, which can comply. So Basel III doesn't really hurt the big banks, and they're the ones that triggered the collapse in the first place. Right. And the little banks that were clean, that didn't do anything wrong, are the ones that are getting hurt by the regulations. So you wonder who imposes these regulations and what the real goal is.
Right. And that goes back to the question, who's setting the policy here?
Yeah. And we don't agree with that. So on the one hand, some people are alarmed because it means we're withdrawing yet again from regulations and our banks might be more free to be more hazardous. But on the other hand, I would agree, we don't want rules set from abroad. We should set our own rules at least.
It was my impression that the community banks and the credit unions were suffering from federal regulations, not BIS.
Right, but the federal regulations are, for example, that the bail-in requirement that is in the Dodd-Frank Act, which is a federal regulation, which says, you know, instead of being bailed out by the federal government, hereafter, when a big bank goes bankrupt, it's supposed to recapitalize itself by basically confiscating the money of its creditors, turning the money of its creditors into capital. And the largest class of creditor of any bank is its depositors. So that's quite alarming to depositors. But that rule was originally set by the Financial Stability Board, and everybody else is supposed to comply with it. So in 2014, the G20 all agreed to do bail-ins instead of bailouts. But whenever they've tried it, like they tried it in Italy, and the Italian government just wasn't ready to let that happen because it was going to be a fraud on the depositors. And so they bailed out the bank anyway, that big bank that went down last December. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of pushback from imposing that rule, even though everybody's supposed to comply with it. But anyway, it originated with the Financial Stability Board, not with Dodd-Frank itself. So the federal regulators are marching to the tune of drummers in Europe, and that's the complaint here.
Well, Ellen, this has been very educational and interesting to put these pieces together, you know, that we've identified the historical basis for the global banking cartel, looked at how the net management has overcome national political sovereignty and is now being challenged by some upstart nations like the United States that would say, hey, we'd like to make our own policy, thank you. Of course, we're a long way from seeing that realized, but it has been quite a process.
Yeah, well, that's actually what it's about, apparently, the globalists versus the nationalists. So the nationalists, it's not just the U.S., but there are nationalist movements all over Europe, starting with Brexit, for example, or Le Pen in France, and a number of other nationalist candidates who basically say we want our own sovereignty, we want to make our own decisions, and that globalists are those forces like the TPP that want big international banks and international corporations to be able to control things and own things without being regulated by government.
Yeah, and as I think we've said on this show probably well over a year ago, the window seems to be closing on the opportunity for the people to push back against these mega policy changes, because the corporate control, corporate rights are superseding those of individual and of national lawmakers. Politicians come and go, parties come and go, but the bankers and financialists are well entrenched and play both sides, have access to whatever they need and the ability to realize what their agenda is. So we
right.
Have
so that's what the deep state is. They're always there pulling the strings.
All right. Well, I'm going to go hide under my pillow. It's always good talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you too.
Thanks, Ellen. Talk to you.
Okay, thank you.
So Bernie Sanders comes out in support of a public bank in Vermont and presumably elsewhere, and the people gathered erupt in applause. It's one of those crowning moments for those in the trenches of creating new American public banks that a mainstream political force validates the concept and the need for the people to keep their money at home to invest in themselves. Vermonters have been at it for years, and were the first ones to get some state-level legislative support for the concept of retaining public dollars for in-state financial investment. But that development provides no guarantee that the State House will respond with the same enthusiasm, if at all. But for the citizens who are relentlessly moving the public bank prospect forward, it's new political leverage that can make a big difference. I spoke with Gwendolyn Hallsmith of Vermonters for a New Economy.
So what does it mean to have Bernie Sanders support a Vermont public bank? Does that extend to a broader profile, Ryan?
Oh, I think so. Because if you look at what he said, he talked in general about the importance of public banks. It wasn't that he was saying it was just really only appropriate in Vermont or anything, which was exciting because he actually was pretty articulate about it. And for me, what it means is that I'll have an antidote to some of the misinformation that has been spread by the opponents of the legislation that we've been filing. You know, I think I've told you this year was a truly awful year in the State House where we weren't even allowed to testify in front of the committees that were taking up the question of a public bank. It was insulting, and the way we were treated was nothing short of abominable, really. I mean, children that propose new state flowers and things at least get to testify in front of the committees typically. It's not an unreasonable thing to expect in our democracy that when you're in favor of a piece of legislation, you'd have the courtesy of being allowed to speak. Yeah, we were treated really like personas non grata, rudely and with a lot of sort of animosity, which was really hard to understand. I mean, we were just proposing a commission to look at it further. It wasn't like we were asking for money or had the legislation already drafted in a kind of half-baked way. No, we were just literally trying to get people interested in exploring it further, and nothing could have been more difficult. It was really crazy. So, and of course, that in part came from the state treasurer, who is firmly opposed to a public bank, and she's a fairly influential person, but fortunately so is Bernie. And so my hope is now that Bernie has been clear about his support for the initiative that we will have something to say back.
What kind of a role does Bernie Sanders play in Vermont politics at this point?
Well, he's our local folk hero, of course. He got over 80% of the vote in the primary, enough to deny Hillary even one vote from the popular vote. But meanwhile, I suppose the corporate Democrats among us, including Howard Dean and Patrick Leahy, have not been supportive of Bernie's bid for the presidency and have had a bit of tone deafness, if you ask me, about his relative popularity in Vermont. I mean, he's our senator and typically doesn't get terribly involved in local political things, which of course is what makes his endorsement of the idea of a state bank all the more important because he doesn't usually weigh in on local issues, and he did in this case.
Well, you have been at the head of the Vermont for 3 years and went right to the wall with the state legislature. You had a mandate almost by a popular vote of the towns. And then you got turned down, handed a remnant from the fiscal table of the state. And now it seems like the people there are kind of on the trail, on the almost on the warpath. But let's get a public bank.
Do the rest
here.
Of the job, basically. Yeah, so, you know, we got partway there. I wouldn't call it a remnant exactly. I wasn't as unhappy with the result of our legislative efforts a couple years ago as some were, partially because I did see it as an opportunity to prove the concept in a fairly low risk way, and I think we did that. We got the 10% program going. And it has proven to be a successful program that's reinvested a lot of money in Vermont. Of course, it can't go the next step without a bank because the next step would actually represent a threat to cash flow without a banking license that grants the bank the right to create credit, which, of course, is the banker's golden key, effectively. And so we really do need the next step to be taken before the full effect of Vermont's recycling our own tax dollars in state for our own benefit would be felt.
Well, now you have formed some new committees, or Citizen Committee of Vermonters for a New Economy, right?
Well, the People's Commission for Vermont State Bank is what has come out of our most recent efforts. Because, as I said, we weren't even allowed to testify at the legislation that was written to establish it. But sort of like the occasion we had a couple years ago when they wouldn't pass our legislation to do the study, you know, it dawned on us, you know, this is just a citizens' commission. Really, even in the legislation, we don't really need permission from the legislature to do that. We can do it anyway.
Right.
And so we set out to form this Citizens Commission for Vermont State Bank, and we're officially kicking that effort off this week with a visit of the Sparkhazard Group are coming here to Vermont and to New Hampshire. We're having a reception for them on Friday afternoon at 5 in the Statehouse cafeteria, and then Saturday and Sunday we've got an all-day workshop working session with them at UVM for 2 days. After that, they'll be, well, at least one of them will be traveling down to New Hampshire for a series of meetings and a fact-finding there about the viability of a public bank. And both states will be off and running on new legislation to be filed either in the next legislative session here and to follow up on the legislation that's already filed in New Hampshire.
All right. Gwen, thanks very much for your report from Vermont, and we'll watch carefully what happens next up in that great state of yours. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Walt. It's been great to talk to you.
That's Gwen Hall-Smith, the former executive director of the Public Banking Institute, and heading up Vermonters for a New Economy. And that's not the only good news for public banking interests in recent weeks, because down in New Jersey, another gubernatorial candidate, Seth Caperdale of the Green Party, has also announced his platform supports the creation of a state public bank for the Garden State, which makes two candidates who are now running on a public bank platform for governor of the state, the other being Democrat Phil Murphy. As long as we're talking about local and regional developments in supporting creation of new public banks, the City Council of Santa Fe, New Mexico, this past week, unanimously decided to appoint a public banking task force that will get into the nitty-gritty of what it will take to start and operate a public bank there. In the past 2 years, Santa Fe has been doing a very thoughtful evaluation of public banking prospects and potentials for the city, including an initial analysis that revealed that the city could save about $25 million in the first 7 years alone of the bank. Now they'll be investigating other financial, legal, and organizational components of the bank, which will set them on a solid path forward as they move toward a final decision to create their own new public bank. Well, as we mentioned earlier, another new endorser of public banks in recent weeks is a person that most Americans would recognize as the great populist challenger to corporate control. The man who decided that perhaps public conveyances like cars shouldn't be allowed to explode on contact, like the old Ford Pintos. Yes, that's right. The author of Unsafe at Any Speed, Ralph Nader. Nader recently wrote a well-publicized article entitled The Savings and Stability of Public Banking, in which he compares the realities of our current private banking system against those of a publicly owned bank such as the Bank of North Dakota for its laudable and remarkable level of public service. In typical Nader educational fashion, he writes, "The government allows banks to have concentrated power. Taxpayers and consumers are charged excessive fees and paid paltry interest rates on savings. The bonds of municipalities are also hit with staggering fees, and public assets like highways and public drinking water systems are corporatized by Goldman Sachs and other privatizers with sweetheart multi-decade leases." You've heard those facts mentioned before here, of course, but Nader is coming to this topic in much the same way most of us have, learning through available facts about what's really going on when you look behind the curtain of global finance and banking. Ralph Nader concludes his piece with this observation. There needs to be much more education of state legislators and the public at large. Such enlightenment would illuminate the enormous savings, along with the restoration of state sovereignty, from the absentee exploitative grip of an unrepentant, speculating, profiteering Wall Street that believes that it can always go to Washington, D.C. for its taxpayer bailouts. Well, Ralph invited Ellen Brown to speak at his convocation entitled Breaking Through Power in Washington, D.C. last fall, and seemed to be making a personal pivot at that time toward public banking. But he's clearly gotten into the fold of support for it now. I thought you might enjoy listening to a conversation that he had with Ellen on his Ralph Nader Radio Hour recently, in which he gave her the floor to describe what a public bank is, how it's working, who it's working for, and other basic considerations that serve as a sort of primer for understanding the public banking prospect. I recommend this excerpt from his show as a way to get clear about some of the basic tenets involved with public banking and to hear Ralph's interactions with Ellen.
Yes, welcome again, Ellen. You're on the move everywhere. You're the great advocate of public banking and its interest, of course, in Europe and elsewhere. But we have a state bank for many years, almost 100 years, in North Dakota. And it's been a model for people who want state banks from California to New Jersey as this effort begins to turn into a higher level of activity, particularly in California, where you live and work, Ellen Brown. So why don't we start out with the model to see how successful it's been compared to the speculative giant banks in New York City who are too big to fail, and therefore they're bailed out by the U.S. taxpayer, as was shown in trillions of dollars during the 2008-2009 Wall Street crash, which, by the way, unemployed 8 million workers and shredded pension funds and mutual funds to a disastrous degree for the hard-pressed owners of these savings. Why don't you start describing the State Bank of North Dakota?
Well, in 2014, I think it was November of 2014, the Wall Street Journal came out with an article that said that the Bank of North Dakota was actually more profitable than J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. In fact, it had a return on equity that was 70% higher than those two banks, which was remarkable. The article attributed it to oil, but after that, we've had an oil bust. Oil totally collapsed, and in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota has still, for the last 12 years, every year reported greater profits than the previous year. So they had their best year ever last year so far, and they're still making 1% or 2% loans to, or they're making 2% infrastructure loans, for example, to local school districts for medical purposes, hospitals, and agriculture, the various sectors that they support. And they make, I think they're at something like 1.6% for student loans. Anyway, they're making quite low-cost loans for the local community. They partner with the local banks. So here's the model. They've been around since 1919, when the farmers in North Dakota were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers, or not Wall Street, it was actually, I think they were in Minneapolis, but anyway, big out-of-state bankers. And so they wanted to keep their money in-state.
They're very conservative. They're still very, you know, it's a very conservative state. So it was not about socialism. It was about state sovereignty. They wanted their money in their state. So they had a movement. It was the nonpartisan. They formed this political party called the Nonpartisan League. They won an election and got their bank instituted and also a state granary instituted, because at that time the bank and the railroad and the granary were basically all one system. So you're forced to take your grain to this out-of-state granary, which went on an out-of-state railroad, and it was all owned by out-of-state banks. And so that's how they were captured. So they were redoing the system themselves. So they won an election, got this bank started, and it's been around for now for nearly 100 years, and it's been exceedingly successful. I mean, it had, of course, a rocky start. They had to fight the bankers, and they had trouble getting the capital together because they were trying to get the capital from the very people that were their competitors. But they did manage to get the bank up and running, and it has been very successful. So the model is that by law, all of the state's revenues are deposited in the bank. So they have a massive deposit bank base. And by now, of course, they've built up a very large capital base as well. I think they have something like $7.4 billion in assets and 10% of that in capital. But originally, it was capitalized on a bond issue. But they also, by law, it's set up as North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. So technically, the bank is part of the government. So they're actually technically backed by the government. And they, rather than competing with the local banks, they partner with the local banks. And they've advised other people inquiring about this model. If you want to set up a state bank in your own state, don't try to compete with your local banks. What you want to do is join them. It's basically the local banks against the Wall Street banks. So they partner with the local banks, which are sort of like the front office, which go out and find the loans and deal with the customers and so forth. And then they participate in the loans, share the proceeds. So they're very helpful to the local bankers. And there are more, I think there are six times as many banks per capita in North Dakota as in any other state. They haven't lost any banks in all this time during the banking crisis, when other states have been, the local banking sector has been shrinking radically.
Yeah, well, let's shift to California, where there's real activity. Where does the money come from, first of all, for the capital base of a proposed state bank of California, you know, like the state pensions, et cetera? Let's briefly talk about where the money can come from to provide the base for a state bank, before we talk about the enormous savings to taxpayers and other beneficiaries.
Well, you could do it like North Dakota did it, which would be a bond issue sold to the public. The problem with that is every state now is up against their own debt ceilings. They're all supposed to balance their budgets. They don't have the option of going further and further in debt like the federal government does. So it's difficult to persuade legislators to go further in debt to capitalize a bank. So my proposal is to get it from the pension funds. California has $500 billion in their pension funds that are always looking for good investments. They want 7% return. So we could say, fine, we'll give you 7% return. This is the publicly owned pension funds, CalPERS and CalSTRS. So if the entity, the state bank, gives the pension funds the 7% that they want, you're still giving the money to state entities, so this is still going to the pensioners, et cetera. It's good for everybody. It's not going out of state. So you can give them 7%, and you can still turn a nice profit, because then get your deposits. California, well, this is my proposal. California has an investment pool of Treasurer's investment pool where they manage all the investments from different agencies around the state. Also, all public money, publicly, you know, state-owned money, publicly owned money that has, I think, about $70 billion in it now. When I first started writing about it, it was making 0.23% interest, but I think it's now up to, it's above 0.5% interest, but it's still making almost nothing. So pay them what they're getting now. Let's say you start with $1 billion bank. So you could get $1 billion from the pension funds. then you can pull $10 billion or make it $11 billion out of the deposit pool, pay them the same interest that they're getting now, or the same return that they're getting now. So if you multiply that out, this allows you to lend 10 times $1 billion. So you can lend $10 billion, and the money is still there in the bank. That's the way a bank works. So you're, let's say you made loans at ordinary infrastructure loans at something like 4%. Or, you know, typical, or you can make all sorts of loans. You can make 2% infrastructure loans to local governments, and you'll still turn a profit. But let's say you were making ordinary 5% loans. 5 times 10, you're making 50% right there. And then you deduct 0.5% times 10, so that's 5%. And then another 7% for the pension fund, so that's 12 from 50. You've just made 38% return, and all the money's going back to state entities. I mean, it's your cost of funds is to yourself. So the whole thing is a win-win-win for all participants.
To put it another way, the California state government puts its money, various pools of money, pension money, other operating cash balances into, let's say, Wall Street banks, and then they have to borrow from these Wall Street banks to provide the money to repair the bridges and the highways and the public schools and the drinking water systems, sewage systems, what's called the infrastructure. And in the meantime, the Wall Street banks are gouging them. They're charging them huge fees. They're charging them what you claim is double what it would be charged by a state bank of California. And they also are fooling around with these risky derivatives. And who knows how scary the lack of security of this whole operation when you get a Citigroup and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase and others operating. They're still in this risky derivatives business. So what you're saying is that to repair or renovate or expand the public works of California, how much will the savings be in percentage?
I don't know.
The cost of borrowing, in other words.
Oh, right. Okay. So if you're funding it yourself, it's your own bank, and you're funding your own state infrastructure, you're going to cut your costs in half because interest is accepted to be 50% on average the cost of infrastructure. So, but if you're doing something like loans to local communities for their infrastructure, like the Bank of North Dakota does, they're making 2% loans versus 4 to 6% for infrastructure loans in other states. I mean, typically, so let's say around 5% for an infrastructure loan versus 2% in North Dakota. So if you're a local community, you can get your money for less than half price. And if you're the state itself, you can get the whole project for half of what it would have cost originally. You see what I mean? You're making a loan. If you're making a loan to yourself, leveraging your own funds, then all the profits go back to you. If you're making a loan to the local community, then the interest is going to go back to the state. But it's still one large entity. It's all the public.
Ellen Brown, how similar would the state bank be to a regular commercial bank in California? In other words, can consumers go in there? Can they deposit their money? Can they have a checking account? Can they get a home equity loan? The way you framed it, it's not quite like that. And there isn't that kind of direct competition with the local commercial banking system.
Right. Well, in North Dakota, they have 2 or 3% individual depositors. And they did that just because they figured, well, we're a public bank. We should make it open to the public. But they actually make it very difficult to bank there. Originally, there was only one branch, right, in the capital city. Now, I guess they've opened another branch. But they don't have ATM machines. Basically, you have to just walk in to do your banking right there in the local branch. So it's not real appealing to individuals. But what they recommend, or what we recommend, is that not to take individual deposits at all, because then you don't have to worry about FDIC insurance or this sort of demand for mortgages and so forth. What you want to do is partner with the local banks and help them to make all those loans that right now they're not actually able to make. They want the business. They want to cater to the local businesses and the local homeowners and so forth, but they don't have the range. Right now, their regulations are very heavily coming down on the local banks. many people say it's very difficult to get a mortgage. You walk in and they require so much paperwork and they're so nervous about the whole thing because of these new regulations. So another model, incidentally, is in Germany with the Sparkassen banks. And in Germany, it's half of their commercial banking is through these local Sparkassen banks, publicly owned, publicly mandated to serve the public, and they just serve their local communities. And part of their network is that they help the local banks with all these regulations that are coming down from the EU. So that's what you can do, is have your state bank, among other services it would offer to the local banks, would be to help them with these very onerous regulations that are putting the banks out of business.
Well, you know, this is going to take a lot of public education. I hope that the State Bank of North Dakota, which is run by very reserved North Dakota managers, will start traveling around the country and talking directly from their almost 100 years of stunningly successful and frugal experience. But Governor Jerry Brown has not bought into your idea. And while there may be a bill in the California legislature in Sacramento, without his support, it's not going to go anywhere. Why does he still insist on borrowing from Wall Street, getting gouged with the fees, and feeding this risky plutocratic giant?
Well, I have heard through the grapevine that he's not opposed. Originally, we had a bill that passed both houses of the California legislature, which was for a feasibility study, and Jerry Brown vetoed it, saying that we don't need another feasibility study, which a blue ribbon committee, which costs extra money. He said, we've already got a banking committee, we can do this in-house. But of course, they never did it. But allegedly, so I've heard, he's open to the possibility. But the problem we've run into, like you say, it takes education. The politicians are generally not bankers. The politicians who get it and who really get excited about this idea are the ones who are bankers. For example, the Phil Murphy, who's running for governor of New Jersey and is the leading Democratic contender, he was a Wall Street banker, and he jumped at the idea as soon as he heard it. He said, I could make that bank profitable, because he understood how banking works. But I've heard three different treasurers or former treasurers or treasury departments say, we don't have the money to lend. We need our revenues for our budget. But that misunderstands how banking works. They're putting their money right now into a Wall Street bank, which is technically or considered to be lending that money out. The Wall Street Bank is doing exactly what we're proposing the state bank would do. But as we now know, banks do not actually lend their deposits, and that's how they get away with all this. They actually create deposits in their books when they make a loan. They just write it into the deposit account, and they can get away with that because they are in charge of deposits, and most people can't tell the difference between deposits that are written into the account and ones that came from somewhere else. And even the ones that did come from somewhere else, they came from some other bank that they created them in that very same way. So they're all creating this loan money that then goes into another bank. So the books are supposed to balance at the end of the day. And if they're lucky, maybe another bank will have made the same kind of loans they've made. And like, let's say you make a $500,000 mortgage and that check finds its way into another bank, you've got to cover that check. But that bank might have made it, also done a $500,000 mortgage that wanders into your bank. So both books balance, but you've just created $1 million that wasn't there before. And if the books don't balance at the end of the day, they only have to balance at night. And then the next day they can be unbalanced all day long. So what they do is they borrow just overnight in the overnight market, repo market, which is very cheap. They can borrow Fed funds, but they hardly do that anymore, borrowing from each other. What they do is they borrow on the repo market or from the Federal Home Loan Banks, which are even cheaper.
And Ellen, you've just demonstrated how hard it is to engage in public education on this idea. And I think it'd be much more effective is to start out with the savings that come to the taxpayer and to people who have public pensions, such as the $500 billion of total state owned or trustee money in California. So you start out with that basis. Once you get into, you know, economics 101 at Yale and how banks create money in terms of extending credit, you're going to lose people. So tell us two things. One, how they can get in touch with you and your organization in California to get more information in plain English. And second, what are the states where the idea of a state bank is percolating in addition to California and New Jersey?
Okay, so my website is webofdebt.wordpress.com or ellenbrown.com. And the Public Banking Institute is at publicbankinginstitute.org.
That's publicbankinginstitute.org. We'll go to the books you've written, the articles. You've presented this idea at all levels of extension and compression for people to read, and you've testified a lot on this. And then indicate which states it's starting to percolate, so people who are listening to this program might be in those states.
Okay, well, California, as you mentioned, and New Jersey and New Mexico, Arizona, Oregon, Washington State, Michigan. We've counted like 50 different groups around the country that are pushing their local legislators for publicly owned banks.
How about Alaska, which has a permanent fund that provides anywhere from $1,500 to $1,800 normally to every child, woman, and man in Alaska coming out of the oil revenues? And how about my home state of Connecticut? Anything going on there?
Actually, you would have to ask Walt, the PBI chairman, because I'm not quite sure. Connecticut, I'm not sure about that. Alaska, I've received emails from people in Alaska asking, inquiring, and I've sent information up there, but I'm not just sure. Again, I'm not really in charge of what's going on, you know, all the networking going on. I'm basically just the writer.
All right. Well, thank you, Ellen Brown. We've been speaking with Ellen Brown, an attorney who heads the Public Banking Institute. You can reach her website by going to the publicbankinginstitute.org. And this is going to be a continuing issue. I can see it's rising around the country to challenge the rapacity of these giant New York banks who still are too big to fail, meaning you, the taxpayer, will bail them out again. Thank you, Ellen Brown.
Thank you.
That's Ellen speaking with Ralph Nader on a recent edition of his Ralph Nader Radio Hour. We're hoping to have much more help from Ralph on the public banking frontier as this movement continues to pick up speed. Now we go to a bracing brief monologue about the current state of banking as delivered by famed economist Michael Hudson, with whom Ellen and I recently presented the topic of public banking to students in the public at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a collaboration between the Pennsylvania Project and the Public Banking Institute. This discussion ranged over a good bit of territory that challenged the common notions of what our banking institutions are and how they practice their franchise. You'll soon see that Michael Hudson, one of the most erudite experts on money and banking history in the world, minces no words about how the banking stage is set.
Yes, if you look in the textbooks that you're given, not here at this university, but in most money and banking textbooks throughout the country, you have a little picture, and it's about a factory and a bank and workers. The bank is making a loan to the factory. The factory buys some equipment. The equipment hires labor, and you have the happy workers walking with lunch pails into the banks. And it's supposed to be the circular flow that banks finance growth. That's not what banks do. Banks don't lend to create new means of production. That's supposed to be the stock market or private capital. Banks only lend against property that's already in place. 80% of bank loans are mortgages to real estate. And the reason real estate prices have been going up throughout the whole country is a property and a house is worth however much a bank is going to lend against it. So let's look back 8 years ago, when you had Citibank, the most reckless bank in the country, making essentially junk mortgage loans. The bank was basically, as Bill Black of the University of Missouri has described, a criminal enterprise. The first thing you do, if you see the old movies of the 1930s, you know that the first thing that the crooked little film noir towns they have in the South, you'll have a local crook, and he's going to have a family member being the head of the police. He's going to want to have a nephew who's a judge. You want to make it sure that there's not going to be any prosecution of what you do. Well, Citibank hired Robert Rubin, who was a Treasury secretary, who moved from Wall Street at a huge salary, and his job was to protect Citibank from prosecution. So Citibank embarked on the largest fraud wave in American history. And the vocabulary all of a sudden expanded the English language. For instance, junk mortgages was a new word in the language, a mortgage that you make to a ninja borrower. No income, no job, and no asset. So the banks would say, we'll just make you any big loan you want, $1 million for a $20,000 house. They'd make, the buyer would go into the bank, he'd sign an IOU, the bank would put $1 million in his account, so you'd have $1 million new money that's created. You usually had to be a friend of the bank, not a family member, but part of the same gang. And the bank would then have $1 million mortgage. What are they going to do with it? They're going to find someone really dumb, like a German savings bank that trusts the Americans, or a pension fund that you take out for a big party and stuff it. Well, in 2008, the whole thing came down, and you had Citibank wiped out. No net worth at all. All the net worth, all the capital that it had, all the stockholder equity was all wiped out by the junk mortgages that it made and their crooked loans. So you had the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that insures all the banks, Sheila Bair, write in her autobiography, she wanted to take it over and say, look, get the crooks out. Well, immediately, President Obama said, wait a minute, my Treasury Secretary works for the head of Citibank, and he's their bag man. He's the job to be here to make sure that nobody's thrown in jail, and I've just appointed an attorney general that's never going to throw a banker in jail because some of them have innocent children and wives, and we don't want them to be hurt. So, although he didn't mind their kicking 10 million American families out of the houses that they had. So basically, they blocked the FDIC from taking over Citibank. But just imagine if the government would have done what it could have done. Here's an insolvent bank run by crooks. Imagine if the government would have taken that over. It could have made honest loans to people who don't default. It could have given you credit cards at much lower credit card rates, at the actual price that it costs to make credit cards. They wouldn't have had to pay 29% interest. They wouldn't have had to make corporate leveraged buyouts to corporate raiders who come in and close factories down. So the picture of banks making loans to companies, they don't loan to companies, they loan to the corporate raiders who buy the companies, lay off the workers, loot the pension funds, smash the company up, and take the money and run. Somehow that didn't get into the textbooks, but that's really what has become. The banking system in this country has become a travesty of the textbooks, and it's become basically a ripoff exercise. So you'd think that this is so obvious to people, with the new words added to the language. In 2009 or 10, the Financial Times had a list of the eight people who'd forecast the crisis to the month, and I was one of the eight. And people said, gee, that's amazing. You forecast it. And that's pretty, the fact is, everybody knew it was going to crash. Thousands of people knew it would crash. They had this movie that they made recently about the guy who was able to bet against the market. I mean, if they would have lent me $1 billion, I would have bet against the market, but I wasn't part of the club to do that. But the fact is, if you have all of the newspapers referring to junk mortgages, the newspapers referring to ninja loans, they all knew that it was crooked, but they thought they could get the money out in time, and they weren't able to. Now, why isn't this in the textbooks? And the reason's quite simple. The commercial banks that are run by simply writing a loan and then charging you interest for something they just do on a computer keyboard. The government can do this on a computer keyboard. It doesn't cost any more money than the electricity costs to run the computer. The banks don't want a discussion of public banking because they don't want the competition. So what I've been told for 50 years, whether it's in Canada or in Germany, they say, oh, if the government creates money, it's going to be inflationary. But that's a myth. It's what psychologists call an implanted memory. You think that it was the banks that somehow lent money to Germany to create the hyperinflation of the 1920s, but every hyperinflation of every country in history, except Zimbabwe, has come from having to pay foreign debt and just print the money to throw onto the foreign exchange market to collapse the currency. So the banks have subsidized a kind of junk economics, a false picture of how banking works, and the textbooks in most of the money and banking courses throughout the country are written by bank lobbyists to make banking appear only to do good things, to make loans that make everybody rich, that don't result in 2008, that don't lead the economy bankrupt, that don't lead to 10 million home foreclosures. None of this reality economics appears in most of the textbooks, and the mass media pick all of this up, and you have sort of economists who are so ignorant of banking that they're the ones that bankers applaud. People like Paul Krugman, who thinks that banks actually are savings banks and doesn't understand that banks do what Ellen understands, that they write a loan, they create a deposit. He said that's impossible. And he got in any of you who are interested can read his debate with Steve Keen, K-E-E-N, an Australian mathematician who was the first person that Krugman ever deigned to actually mention his name. And if you like the movie Bambi Meets Godzilla, read that debate and you'll see, you know, what happens when you have reality economics confront the bank lobbyists, we call them, what did we call them? Learned ignorance.
Oh, no, institutionalized deception.
Institutionalized deception. I love that word.
That's my phrase there. So Michael's describing this rather, you know, shocking, perhaps, and certainly a very troubling reality of how our money and our money system is working. And another word for what has happened is that the banking industry has become financialized. Financialization is the term. Financialization is exactly as he described. It's using the assets of others to build the profit margins and the profit ledgers of those who have the money to participate, instead of putting it into the economy to build schools and all of that.
And so it went at Franklin and Marshall College a few weeks ago, as Michael Hudson, Ellen Brown, and I broke the news to students that money and banking, as essential as we've made them to our communities and economies, are not as they typically appear. That the systems on which both are operated have design flaws, which enable the private parties that issue and control our money and banking systems to protect themselves from harm while their clients, both near and far, must pay for the privilege of going further and further into unsustainable debt. This reality is actually the hard backstop of the good news story of public banking, which, as Ellen said to the students earlier that evening, is our first attempt in a century to reclaim the power to create and protect our own money. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.